Welcome to the Wellsteading Podcast. This is episode 73. It's January 14th, 2015. I'm your host, John Pugliano. I'm also the founder and money manager at investablewealth.com. Here at the Wellsteading Podcast, we try and teach you from the 10 wealth building principles to help you build not only your net worth, but more importantly, your personal freedom and independence. I like to say that money may not buy happiness, but it can buy freedom. And that's up to you. If you'd like to learn more about my philosophy on building wealth and some of my personal experiences, how I got to be where I'm at today, then go back and listen to the first 10 episodes of this podcast. That's where I lay out the foundation that's helped me build my wealth and, more importantly, my personal freedom over nearly the past 30 years. The market continues to be extremely volatile, and although it closed down today, that's the fourth trading session in a row, the one little bit of good news, I'd say it closed in probably the upper 25% of its trading range. As I say, that's better news because in the past 3 days, it's been closing closer to the bottom 25% of that range. Still overall, though, not good news. The market is well below its 50-day moving average. I'd say probably halfway between the 50-day and the 200-day moving average is where it closed. The S&P 500 today got as low as 1988. And the lows of today actually undercut the lows that we saw back on December 6th when the market started to unwind from its all-time highs. So we'll wait and see what happens. The market seems to have found some support right around the high levels that it reached back in September. We'll wait until the end of the week and see how things finish up, and then I'll give you some market commentary at that point. In today's episode, what I'd like to discuss with you is one of the reasons that the market is having so much vacillation and volatility. And I say one of the reasons because there are many. And again, that's why I talk about thin ice and I talk about how really since Christmas time, I pulled out of the market. I'm pretty much in cash and I'm waiting to see how things work themselves out because it's just been too volatile of a market for me. Just look at what's going on. Interest rates are back at historic lows. Today, the 10-year Treasury closed out at 1.86%. Now, the only time it's been lower than this was back during the summer of 2012, just before the Federal Reserve started pumping up the printing presses with QE3. They did that because it was their third and final attempt to try and revive the economy and get it growing after the Great Recession. And it did do that, but they had to literally increase their balance sheet by trillions and trillions of dollars to build momentum in this economy. So the question you have to ask yourself is if we are recovering, then why are rates going down instead of up, especially when the Federal Reserve has supposedly stopped quantitative easing in October and they're scheduled to start raising their Fed funds rate sometime in the next 6 months or so. Well, incidentally, I talk about this and a few other things that we'll briefly discuss here today in an article that I wrote over at investablewealth.com. That's my advisory firm's website. If you'd like to check that out, that's investablewealth.com, and it's under the observations and commentary section. We'll look around the world. We see slow growth in China, perhaps moderate growth in India. Nobody knows for sure, but they're projecting growth in India. The emerging markets are not showing any promise at this point, although I will point out the Philippine stock market has just been on fire the past few weeks, really probably for the past 6 weeks or so. A lot of money is pouring into their economy, but I really don't see a great reason for it at this point. And then all their neighbors, Cambodia, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, they're extremely weak right now. None of them look as good as China. And we know that China's numbers are always questionable anyways. Japan's continuing their 25-year stagnation. They've devalued their currency and made their exports so cheap it's really putting pressure on all of their neighbors, such as China, South Korea, Taiwan. You see, they're exporting their problems to all those other countries. Things are still abysmal in Europe. Germany's on a pretty decent track, but there's problems everywhere else. Countries in Northern Europe, which have relied on oil exports, are now suffering. The countries in Southern Europe have never recovered from the recession. Italy, France, Portugal, they have absolutely no growth prospects, and they're perpetually on the verge of bankruptcy. Now, later this month, the European Central Bank is supposedly going to come out with their long-awaited plan to do their quantitative easing. That's really what has collapsed the euro in the last 6 months or so. The president of their central bank, Draghi, he's from Italy. He keeps talking up the fact that they're going to have quantitative easing. There's some real concerns and questions as to how that mechanism is going to work. Because remember, they're not a solid united country like the United States is. The European Union doesn't have the strength and authority and pricing power that the United States federal government has. So people are really waiting to see what the European Central Bank can do. Up till now, Draghi's been doing a lot of talk, but there's been no action. So we'll find out later this month what plan they put in place, and we'll see if that makes the markets happy. You have to remember, Interest rates in Europe now are extremely low. Switzerland is 0.15% on their 10-year treasury. Germany, 0.42. The Netherlands, 0.48. France, 0.65. These rates are well less than half of what we have in the United States and were at historical lows. So you have to ask yourself, exactly what can the European Central Bank do to stimulate the economy in Western Europe if interest rates that are well below 1% aren't doing anything? We also have the Greek question. Is Greece going to stay in or out of the European Union? Are they going to default on their debts? You know, what's going to happen there? Their elections are coming up at the end of this month, and that's uncertainty for the market as well. In my article today over at investablewealth.com, I talk about the world really experiencing a triple convergence of three things. And this is cheap money, that's cheap money in the form of interest rates, cheap energy, and cheap commodities. So there's the triple convergence. Money, energy, and commodities are all extremely inexpensive right now, all around the world. So you have to ask yourself, are the world economies either poised for explosive growth, or are we on the verge of a major correction? Now that's a question I can't answer. These three things, cheap money, cheap energy, cheap commodities, that's either going to propel global growth and stimulate world commerce, or on the other hand, these three things are so cheap because they're a harbinger of the fact that the global economies are such a mess, that all the debt that's accumulated, all the easy money that's been printed, that there's just massive overcapacity and malinvestment, and there has to be a correction to level the playing field. Now again, I have no idea which one of these scenarios is going to play out. I watch the markets every day. I'm reactionary. I try and swing trade as I see momentum ebb and flow. And right now, the markets are too volatile. I don't see any distinctive trends, and that's why I'm sitting it out. Now, there are no shortages of uncertainties and problems that are currently causing this vacillation and volatility in the stock market. And we don't have time today to discuss all of them. So I just want to focus in and discuss one problem area, one uncertainty. And I'm going to do that just to give you an idea of how bad things could be, and consequently why there's so much fear in the markets. And I'm just going to do this at a very high level, but I want you to realize the very real possibility of a Russian default. And think about that. Think about what consequences that would have for global financial markets. You're always hearing about the U.S. debt and U.S. deficits and how the U.S. may default and what that would mean, or you know, Congress not raising the debt limit and things like that. But what I think is a more likely scenario is that Russia would default. Now, it's hard to say exactly how much debt they have and how much would be at risk for default. I've seen numbers vary drastically, but I have seen some pretty reliable numbers that say that somewhere between $120 and $150 billion, and that's in U.S. dollars, that's coming due in 2015, and then it escalates from there as to the money that's owed by their private industry, by their oligarchs. See, the vast majority of their debt has been loaned to the West, and it's either denominated in U.S. dollars or in euros. And you have to remember, the Russian ruble has just collapsed in the wake of these lower oil prices. It's down something like over 50% against the U.S. dollar. They've had to raise their interest rates to nearly 17% just to keep their economy from collapsing. So I'm not talking about things that are impossible to happen. Now, I don't know the likelihood of them, but they are totally possible. And don't forget, it was just 17 years ago or so, in 1998, that Russia did default on their debt. That's when they came out of being the Soviet Union. And we'll come back to that in a minute. So here's what's going on with Russia. They owe the West a lot of money. And again, that's European banks and American banks. They've done this to build infrastructure in their economy. Now, these are now controlled by what we call the oligarchs. These are the people and the families that are friendly with the Russian government and the aftermath of the Communist Party and the KGB and things like this. These are basically what we'd call in the U.S. crony capitalists. But they're even more extreme there. I mean, they are true oligarchs. Those oligarchs took possession of all the state-owned companies after the Soviet Union fell apart, and then they came to the West and asked for loans so that they could build the infrastructure they needed to increase their industrial base and, more importantly, to extract their natural resources. You see, Russia is really just an exporter of commodities. Their biggest product is petroleum, so that's why the decline in oil prices is hurting them so much. And then they're also large exporters of other national resources, so they're really just a big commodity player. Well, Western banks and Western businesses were happy to go into Russia after the Soviet Union fell and invest in what they thought was going to be a stream of cheap commodities. And although there's always been issues, in the last decade or so, the fact that we've had very high oil prices have really been the glue that's held Russia together. Every time there's been tension in the Middle East or problems with Islamic terrorism, that's bolstered the price of oil and basically raised it up above $90 or $100 a barrel. That's been very good for Russia. And in my opinion, that's also the reason I think that Russia is so happy when there's geopolitical instability in the Middle East. They can benefit from the OPEC cartel without ever being a part of the OPEC cartel and not having to abide by its guidelines, which is exactly right now why we're seeing Saudi Arabia and the other major oil producers of OPEC, we're seeing those Arab states refusing to cut their production, because when they've done that in the past, companies like Russia and Venezuela don't participate in the quotas, and they end up taking more market share away from the Saudis. And that's one of the reasons we're seeing an oversupply of oil and a collapse in the price of oil. But here's the bottom line. Russia doesn't have a developed economy. Despite their long-established cultural and ethnic identity, they have a very poorly developed economy. Now, this may be a surprise to you, because in recent years, you've heard of them described as an emerging market. In fact, they were part of what was called the BRICS nations. That's BRICS as in Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, most of which those countries right now are having major economic problems. But they were supposed to be the growth engine that was going to propel the world out of the financial crisis that the United States got itself into in 2007 and 2008. Well, that didn't happen, and here we are in 2015, and it looks like one of the only countries with substantial growth is the United States. But let's get back to Russia. Okay, so you may think of them as an emerging, powerful market, or more than likely, you just think of them as a very strong government. Since the end of World War II, so that's the last 70-some-odd years, we've heard that the Soviet Union and the Russians were a superpower. Well, when they were together as a Soviet Union, they did have a lot of power, but they never had a strong economy. That's why their empire disintegrated and fell apart in the early 90s, and then when Russia was on its own, by 1998, they had a default on their debt. And again, I'm going to come back to that in a minute here. But for now, let's just focus on this. Let's focus on the myth and the fairy tale that you've been told that Russia is just this omnipresent, huge, powerful country. Well, it's not. And I'm not saying this to disparage the Russians. That's not the point. I'm just pointing out how you've been hearing distortions and propaganda because you think Russia is this all-powerful country. They have this strong military. They have this big space program. They have this vast geographic land, you know, full of resources. They're such a strong competitor to the United States. They fight us in the Olympics. They fought us in the Cold War. They're fighting the West and NATO right now, trying to extend their borders into the Ukraine. They have nuclear weapons, on and on. These are all these things you've been told. But did anybody ever tell you that the Russian economy was barely $2 trillion? That's right, barely $2 trillion. That's their whole GDP. And that's what it was last year. Now that both oil and the ruble have plunged over 50%, I'm sure that in 2015, Russia's GDP is going to be under $2 trillion. Well, let me put that into perspective for you. The state of California, their GDP is over $2 trillion. Now, California is a powerful state, but if you're familiar with it, you know that they've gone to the extreme with big government. Their government intervention, their social programs, all the things they've done in California have almost ruined and bankrupt the state. Even though it's an immensely developed and plentiful economy, they still have budget deficit issues in California. But remember, California is just a state. California doesn't have its own Navy. They don't have their own Air Force. They don't have their own military. They don't have their own nuclear weapons. They don't have their own borders to protect. They don't have to manage the huge bureaucracy of the Russian government. California also isn't fighting a war with the United States. California isn't fighting NATO. It isn't invading its neighbors. And yet, California still has budget issues. So the point I'm trying to make is, can you understand how Russia, with now less than a $2 trillion economy, what kind of financial straits they're in? When you realize that although they have vast geographic area, their GDP is less than the state of California. That's a problem, and with these low commodity prices and these low oil prices, it's a very real possibility that Russia may have to default on their loans. And that may be just what they need to do to get out of the sanctions that they're under because of the problems that they're having with their neighbors in the Ukraine. And I want to say something about those sanctions that the West has put on Russia. I personally don't believe those sanctions are what's crippling Russia. Yes, of course, the sanctions would be doing some damage, but understand this. I just told you that Russia's major export is oil, and supposedly the West has placed sanctions on doing business with Russia. But do you realize that Russia's production and capacity for oil is at an all-time high? Right now, it's as high as it ever was when they were part of the big Soviet Union. So I would ask you, if these sanctions are being so effective, then why is Russia producing record amounts of oil, right? Who are they selling it to? They obviously must be selling it. You see, oil is fungible. The U.S. and Europe can put sanctions on Russia all they want, but if Russia produces oil and they put it in a ship, there's plenty of economies and countries around the world that will buy that oil from Russia. It's fungible. They can buy it, and even if they don't use it themselves, they can just resell it to somebody else. So all that Russian oil is coming out of the ground. It is going into the marketplace. It's coming out in record numbers. It's coming out at a time when the ruble and the price for petroleum have dropped over 50%, and yet they're still producing record levels of oil. And why is that? Because they need the money. That's the whole point. And that's why I believe that they're critically at the level of default. Now, again, I don't know if they will or won't. I have no way of knowing that. I'm just pointing this out to you because this is one of the uncertainties that's creating the volatility in the marketplace right now. There are many geopolitical problems that could create a financial crisis, and that's why the market is so unstable. And the fear of a Russian collapse is one of them. And again, I don't know how likely it is, but I know it's not improbable. And so people factor in that risk and uncertainty, and that's what causes volatility in the marketplace. Now let's get back to 1998, the last time Russia defaulted on its debt. Things are a little different today. For one thing, because of these high oil prices over the last decade or so, Russia has built a substantial war chest of money of foreign reserves. So they hold a lot of U.S. dollars and they hold a lot of euros. That's why now they're able to pay a 17% bond yield. And that's how so far they've been able to protect the ruble from totally imploding. So that's one difference, and that's a good thing. That may just be able to stabilize them and buy them some time. The other thing that's a major difference is that in 1998, all the debt that Russia owed was actually public debt. It was debt that was owed by the government of Russia or by the former Soviet Union, the debts that they incurred from the former Soviet Union. But it was all public debt. The government owned it. The government was responsible for it. So what happened? They defaulted. All those companies, all those state-run companies, all those resources, all that infrastructure was bundled up and given to crony communists. You know, in the U.S., we call them crony capitalists. Over there, they're crony communists. But all those immense resources, all that capital, all those things, all those companies that were state-owned, that were publicly owned, that was transferred over to the, quote, private sector, which were really just these families and individuals that were friendly with the communist government, these crony communists. Those are what have evolved to be called the oligarchs. Okay, so this oligarchy has been running the show for the last 17 years. Here they are in 2015 with the collapse of oil and commodity prices. They're nearly bankrupt again. And so the way I see it, this is just a replay of 1998, except it has a little twist to it. They're going to do it in reverse. Remember, 1998, the state went bankrupt, and all the resources and the companies were put in the hands of the oligarchs. Well, here we are this time around, now with all the debt in the hands of the private companies, and the oligarchs are responsible for that debt. So what I think will happen this time, if Russia does in fact have to default on their debt, I believe it'll be the oligarchs, their private companies, which will default. They'll refuse to pay their loans. They'll say that they're insolvent. So I think when the oligarchs default, President Putin comes in, he nationalizes all those companies, he nationalizes all those resources, and he lets the state take over those enterprises with a clean balance sheet because all the debt will have been wiped out and will have belonged to the oligarchs. So he'll blame it on them. The Russian government will confiscate all this property, and it will be an exact reverse play of what they did in 98. The state will take over what they say the oligarchs stole 17 years ago. Sound far-fetched? Maybe, but I don't think so. But again, this is just one of the things that's weighing on the stock market. Global weakness, recession in Europe, the fear of bankruptcies and defaults throughout the energy sector, instability in many of the smaller countries that are energy producers, the terrorism that's going on in France right now. Is it any wonder that the markets are so volatile? Well, that's why right now I'm not participating. And I want to reiterate to you, you don't have to participate either. To keep yourself in a cash position is an investment option and it is an investment decision. And many times it's the best investment decision that you can make. Now, I can't offer you advice or recommendations on this podcast, but what I do want to say is that I know that many of you, and I hear from you, so I know this is true. Many of you have not participated in this bull market. It's gone on now for about 6 years. It's long in the tooth. A lot of money has been made, but it's getting old. It's getting tired, and a lot of you feel that you've missed it, and so you're trying to get into the market now. But I would caution you, we're just 4% off of all-time record highs. There's a lot of instability throughout the world economies. There's a great deal of volatility in the markets. If you haven't participated in the markets up till now, if you haven't enjoyed the benefits of being in the market in the last few years, if you don't have a great deal of investment experience, this is probably not the right time for you to start investing. Just think about that. We haven't had a correction of more than 10% since 2011. That's a long time to go without a correction. You've worked too hard for your money to risk losing 15 or 20% if the market does decide to correct. So I just encourage you, be cautious. As always, if you have questions or concerns or comments for me, you can reach me through the website, wealthsteading.com. I'm very appreciative to all of you that have gone out and subscribed to the show in iTunes, and especially those of you that have left us comments and reviews. Thank you so very much for that. Until our next episode, this is John Pugliano wishing you the very best of returns.